House State Affairs will now come to order. It's about just a couple of minutes after 8 o'clock, and today we're going to have an oversight hearing on the division of elections. But first, I'd like to have you please call the roll.
Representative Grunberg, not present. Representative Peterson.
Here.
Representative Johansson.
Not present. I have a note here. Is he on the phone?
He's on the phone. I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Here.
Representative Seaton.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Chair Lynn.
Here. Okay, thank you very much. Again, we're going to have an oversight hearing of the Division of Elections this morning. And I think all of us here at this table, and in fact, you know, around the state, we all had interesting elections. Some are more interesting than others, especially, we had three write-in campaigns that I know of. We had two in the legislature, and of course we had the election for United States Senator, and that was highly publicized and a very spirited campaign. The committee today on this hearing has no intent whatsoever to get into the politics or the personalities or the results of any of those other elections. Those elections are over, and the results are what the results are. I do want to, at this point, take a moment to especially thank the Division of Elections, and especially Gail Fernumiai, for the hard work under a great deal of stress, which was the focus of the national spotlight. You probably didn't realize you were going to get into anything like that when the time came. This morning, I had some notes here on what happened to them, but this morning we're going to walk through some of the procedures and issues that were faced by the Division of Elections and some of your recommendations. I've asked the committee to submit to me a number of questions for the Division of Elections, help us understand what's going on, what we might do in the future, and I assume that the Division of Elections has received those questions and can respond to it. We are going to have this oversight hearing this morning focusing on some of those write-in candidate issues, and I do know that the Lieutenant Governor's Office, which oversees the Division of Elections, is going to be conducting their own independent review of some of these issues, and I believe that report is going to be out sometime in March or perhaps early April. We're all looking forward to hearing the results of that. I do know also that we have some individually sponsored legislations, both in this body and in the other body, on this subject, and my intent as chairman is to wait until this oversight hearing is complete and or the internal investigation by the Division of Elections before we hear any of those individually sponsored bills. And we may want to consider, depending on what we learn here today and what we learn from the internal review, we may want to consider a committee bill to address some of the issues. So it should be very interesting. It's very, very important to all of us. And so with that, I would invite Division of Elections to come to the table, yourself or anybody you'd like to bring with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. With me today, I'm Gail Fanumiai from the Division of Elections, and with me today is also Sarah Felix from the Department of Law.
And thank you again.
And I am, well, thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity to address the questions that the committee presented to the division as follow.
Could you speak up just a little bit?
Okay. I appreciate the opportunity to address the questions that the committee presented to the division as a result of the 2010 general election, which we all know was a very unique election and the first one of its kind in the state of Alaska's history. I'm not sure the format you want to use, Mr. Chairman, if you want
why don't you give just a quickie overview of the Division of Elections. I know you have more than just counting ballots, but just a very brief overview of the overall function of Division of Elections, and then launch into the primary focus of the hearing that we're having today.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the Division of Elections is, as you know, responsible for conducting all state and federal elections. We also conduct the Regional Educational Attendance Area and Coastal Resource Service Area elections annually every October. The Regional Educational Attendance Area elections are school board elections in unorganized communities throughout Alaska. The division is also responsible for maintaining the statewide voter registration list, responsible for list maintenance of that list, removing voters who, for various reasons, are no longer eligible to vote. We are also responsible for processing the initiative petitions, referendum petitions, and recall petitions. And just general, also the division will be faced with redistricting this year. As soon as the redistricting committee presents a redistricting plan, the division will be tasked with then drawing precinct boundaries in the new House districts, excuse me, and reassigning all voters in the state to new voting precincts.
Let me ask you on the redistricting. Where are you now in that? When do you really get started on that? And when might folks in Alaska find out, you know, what those final boundaries are?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding the redistricting committee will most likely present a final plan to the division next April. Sometime next year. What the division is currently doing is purchasing new equipment to help us with our redistricting process, and we'll be undergoing some training to learn our new mapping system, and we're working now with cleaning up our list, making sure voters are all, you know, that there aren't any precincting issues with voters at this time.
Thank you. Continue. Well, let me. The very first question, I'm going to kind of jump ahead a little bit. The very first question I want to address before we go any further, is there anything that you might talk about today, or any questions that we ask, or any legislation that we may propose or somebody propose on the issues of the write-in, future write-in policies? Will any of those impact in any way whatsoever the outcome of any pending lawsuits that are left over from the contest for United States Senator?
Mr. Chairman, one can never guess how an opposing party is going to use information that they hear from the state against the state in any kind of lawsuit, but we feel that the information that we discussed today will not have any negative impact on any of the pending lawsuits still before the state of Alaska.
Yeah, because we have no intent of doing that. That's a priority. And who are the parties of that lawsuit, just so we know?
Well, the Miller v. Treadwell case is still pending. The only unresolved issue in that is attorney fees in the Superior Court case. And if you have any detailed questions about the cases, Sarah Felix from Law probably is more apt and able to answer those than myself.
I don't know if I want to get, you know, too far into that, because, you know, we could be on dangerous ground.
The other case, there are two other cases, Rudolph v. State of Alaska, which is a federal district court case. It involves some pre-clearance issues challenging the division's process that we use to count the write-in votes. The plaintiffs are Harold Frederick Rudolph Sr., Gerald Google Jr., April Pugh, Kevin Height, John M. McKenzie, and Lola G. McKenzie, and that's a federal court case.
And none of the candidates that were involved in the last election are directly involved. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
The last case is Perry v. Treadwell, which is a state election contest case, and the plaintiffs are Rod Perry, Lola Gale McKenzie, John Mark McKenzie, similar names from the previous case, Robert W. Rude, Harold Frederick Rudolph Sr., Gerald S. Google Jr., Greg Pugh, April J. Pugh, John A. Lowe, Margaret R. Lowe, David B. Long, Barbara J. Struble, Dick Stoffel, Harmony Shield, and Amy Walker.
Okay, please continue.
Would you like me just to continue with the next question? Those are the cases that are pending.
Any way you want to present it.
Okay. It probably would be easier, Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow the questions in the order in which I received them.
Okay, and then I invite the committee at any time to ask your questions through the chair. Thank you.
The next question presented to the division, Mr. Chairman, was, could similar names be problematic with using intent? This is a hypothetical question, and it's impossible to answer in a vacuum without knowing the surrounding circumstances about a writing campaign and an election. But the bottom line is that the Alaska Supreme Court has historically and repeatedly admonished the division to implement an honor voter intent in counting ballots.
And how does the court define intent?
Sarah, do you have a response to that?
Mr. Chairman, Sarah Felix from the Attorney General's Office. The court, when considering issues of voter intent, looks at a ballot. They look at what the marks are that the voter has placed on a ballot. They look at the surrounding circumstances of a given campaign, and they use a standard where they seek to enfranchise a voter to the maximum extent possible.
Yeah, we're going to explore intent a little more deeply later on. Please continue.
The next question, Mr. Chairman, talked about tracking custody of ballots, and can a person have physical custody of ballots who's not specifically authorized or regulated? Alaska statute requires that ballots be numbered in series to assure simplicity and to prevent fraud, and that's in Alaska statute 1515.030, parent 2. State regulations list out a series of requirements that deal with ballot transportation and security. They require that all hand-counted ballots at the precincts be sealed and mailed to the director's office no later than the day following the election. And upon receipt in the director's office, they're logged as being received, and then they are stored and secured in an alarmed and locked ballot room. That is in State Regulation 6AAC 25060. All voted ballots counted by optical scan machines on election night are transported on election night to a designated location and secured until they're picked up by a licensed and bonded courier service or licensed security officer. Chain of custody documents accompany the ballot shipments. Access to the ballots prior to shipment is limited to election personnel, state troopers, or authorized licensed security officers. Based on regulations and the division's practices and policies, we do not allow any unauthorized person access to ballots. During the writing counting process, the ballots were in the director's office in the alarmed secured ballot room prior to being taken down to the counting facility. And before the ballots were removed from the ballot room, they were logged and identified as to what ballots were being taken. The security officers then transported the ballots to the counting facility. When they were received at the counting facility, they were once again checked in to assure that every envelope that they were told was in those boxes were still in those boxes. Okay. And then the same thing happened when they were brought back to the division.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for not reading the question. I must have wrote it late at night. My English teacher would have given me a pretty bad grade on that question. But anyway, so when you say no authorized person can have custody of the ballots, but are there steps in that chain? I mean, how does authorization given? I mean, is that spelled out? I mean, can somebody does somebody have the discretion at some point in the handling of these ballots to be able to authorize others, someone else to have access? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, authorized personnel are election workers, Division of Elections staff, any licensed bonded security courier, and the troopers, and a licensed security officer. The ballots in hand count precincts are secured by the election worker after the precinct. They are sealed. The envelopes are signed over by the workers. That election worker has custody of those ballots until they're able to be delivered to the post office the next morning. Ballots in larger communities, say, as in Fairbanks, the Fairbanks North Star Borough area, the municipality of Anchorage, are delivered by the workers to the elections offices where they are secured until the selected courier, who's licensed and bonded, picks up, identifies how many ballot envelopes and boxes they have. At no point during all this process do they leave either security officer the custody of the, like the freight company at Alaska Airlines, and then they are picked up by another licensed security officer. They're checked in at the division. The Division of Elections personnel are authorized people to be able to handle those ballots as well.
Thank you. And I look at the regulations after I wrote the question and saw that, but I just want to ask you, as far as you're concerned, you're comfortable with the fact that the regulations covered and the procedure is handled in a way that the custody process of the ballots is, you're comfortable with that, with the way it is right now? I'm asking.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, yes, I am very comfortable with the process.
Thank you.
Now, those be, are those from regulation or from statute? I probably should know the answer, but
I'm sorry,
there goes
Mr.
my
Chairman?
Cell phone.
He brings donuts every day. So
I bring it every day. But we're not gonna do that.
Mr. Chairman, the transportation security topics that I just covered, chain of custody and how the ballots are secured, is in state regulation.
Thank you. Any follow-up?
Oh,
okay, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually was contacted by a voter one time who said, well, since all the ballots were numbered, he didn't think it would be very hard for there to be a pair of numbers on there, one of them could be torn off and given to the voter, like sort of like a receipt, so that they could track their vote somehow to make sure that their vote was counted. I don't know if that's possible or not, but I just thought since we were talking about this subject that I'd ask that.
Through the chair, Ms. Representative Peterson, there's no way to identify a ballot to a voter once it is put through the optical scan machine or hand counted. And that is to preserve the individual's right to a secret ballot.
Okay.
I would buy donuts for the committee, but they're already over there.
Yeah.
Okay. Like to continue? Any other questions on this particular subject? Okay, would you please continue?
The next question talks about documenting the number of ballots printed and the number counted, and how are surplus ballots accounted for. Each voting location is provided with a series of sequentially numbered ballots, and this information is written on documents provided to the voting locations. And at the end of voting, the election worker is to identify the number of ballots used and subtract that from the total number of ballots received. And the remainder of the unvoted ballots are destroyed at the precinct or returned to the division for destruction. Voted ballot stubs are returned to the Division of Elections. And again, Regulation 6AAC 25060.
Any follow-up on that? Representative Kelly.
Again, just a little more clarification. So does the election worker then have the option to destroy them? So is that the way, an option for them? I mean, you said they either do this or that. They either send it back or they destroy. Do they decide?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, in most cases, if there is a small number of ballots that are unused, they are destroyed at the precinct and they rip them in half, and then they return the ripped in half ballots usually back to the division. Some precincts have a very large quantity of unused ballots that are put in an unused ballot envelope and returned to the division for shredding.
Follow up.
So you're comfortable again, that I mean, there's a balance sheet kind of thing. The number, do you keep track of the number destroyed and do some kind of comparison and check with the number cast to, you know, and make sure that number is equal? And you know, I've never actually been an election worker. My wife has, and I just, the process, that's, you know, I haven't seen it behind the scenes, and I, you know, I'm a little just trying to get more information on how it works.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that's correct. Precinct workers complete a ballot statement on the back of the precinct register at the end of the evening to account for how many ballots they used, including the ballots, the people who signed a precinct register and voted a ballot, those who voted question ballots, any special needs ballots that were issued. And then they do the math and figure out that they had X number of people voted, they should have used X number of ballots, they have X number that need to be destroyed.
One last follow-up.
Go ahead.
On the, you know, you hate to think this way, but if there was a election worker that was less than honest, there's plenty of opportunity. How does that work? I mean, is there more than one person there? Say they wanted to fill in some extra ballots, you know, and because they have access, right, to who voted and who didn't vote. So it seems like they would know, they would have information, you know, I mean, I'm just asking if probably that happens, right? I mean, or does it? I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I've never heard of that happening, and at following an election, you're correct, they do have access to who's voted and who hasn't voted. There is a team of, you know, 4 to 6 workers at a precinct. They sign an oath to do their duties faithfully and according to state law. Following every election, the State Review Board, which is a group of registered voters in the state of Alaska, that's part of their job, is to make sure that the number of ballots used at a precinct matches the number of cards cast at that precinct.
Thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record and understand it. Like I said, I've never been there, and my wife is probably growling at me behind the scenes watching on TV for questioning, but thank you.
Uh-huh.
Where do you get your election workers? All the election workers in precinct XYZ, are they all residents of that district, or do they have to be, or is the supervisor a resident of that particular district, or do they come from any place?
Mr. Chairman, we each regional supervisor in our 4 election offices recruit their workers, and they try to their best to get workers from that specific precinct. They have to be registered voters in the state of Alaska. Many of our election workers are repeat election workers and have been working these elections for many, many years. And I can't say enough good things about the thousands of people that work 15 to 16 hours, 2 days every other year, because we could not get our job done without them.
I don't know any election I've ever been involved in. My hat's off to election workers. They very courteous and do a very good job. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't hear you mention anything about the spoiled ballots.
Spoiled.
Sometimes a voter will make a mistake and will ask to have another ballot. And so do they have a separate category where they keep track of those, or are those just torn up?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, those are tracked on the precinct register. There's a little box that they check for how many ballots were spoiled, and then those are included into the overall accountability for how many ballots were used that night.
Okay.
How's that work? If I go in an election booth and I make a mistake or change my mind halfway through, what do I do then if I want to cast another ballot? Would I bring it out and give it to a worker and give me another one, or what happens at that point?
Mr. Chairman, you could return to the election worker and say, I made a mistake on my ballot. I would like another ballot. They will destroy your ballot and give you a new ballot to vote. You're allowed, excuse me, you're allowed 2 replacement ballots at the polling place on election day.
Okay. Thank you. Any follow-up? Okay, please continue.
The next question was, how or why did the Division of Elections determine that voter intent should be the standard for counting write-in votes in contradiction to the statute mentioned above? And I'm not sure what the statute mentioned above was, but the division would disagree that consideration of voter intent contradicted statute.
Could you review this statute briefly?
Pardon me?
Could you review
I believe it was
applicable statute briefly.
15360.
Both wide benefit and
A11 and 12.
We have to remember a lot of the folks watching this on Gavel to Gavel don't have immediate access to these.
15-15-360, 10 through 12 state that in order to vote for a write-in candidate, the voter must write in the candidate's name in the space provided and fill in the oval opposite the candidate's name in accordance with parent 1 of this section. A vote for a write-in candidate other than a write-in candidate for governor and lieutenant governor shall be counted if the oval is filled in for that candidate and if the name as it appears on the write-in declaration of candidacy of the candidate or the last name of the candidate is written in the space provided.
And
so the issue with that statute, Mr. Chairman, was that the Miller Group was reading that and believing that the name had to be exactly as it was written on a candidate's letter of intent. No room for errors, no room for misspelling. It had to be exactly as the candidate printed it on that document that the Division of Elections had.
And in review, the statute says what? As far as spelling the name correctly?
Mr. Chairman, doesn't talk about perfect spelling. It just says as it appears on the candidate's write-in declaration of candidacy.
And so it had to be the same as what it, and you have access to that, I assume, when you look at these ballots, where they actually filed for the write-in. And I get it. What does "as it appears" mean?
I think I would like to. Can I finish?
Sure. Sure.
If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, responding,
fine.
Then I'm going to have the lawyer over here give you what the court said about "as it appears."
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Anyway, as I was saying, Mr. Chairman, that you know, the division would disagree that consideration of voter intent contradicts statute. The Supreme Court in the recent Miller-Treadwell case determined that consideration of voter intent was consistent with the statute on rules for counting ballots. And again, the Supreme Court has historically and repeatedly, you know, admonished the division for considering and honoring and implementing voter intent when counting ballots. So I would like Sarah can go ahead and respond to the "as it appears."
Through the chair, Sarah Felix from the Attorney General's Office. In the Miller v. Treadwell case, the Alaska Supreme Court rejected the argument propounded by the Miller plaintiff, saying that the "as it appears" language does not require a standard of perfection in writing in the candidate's name. The court recognized that the statute would allow for minor misspellings, it would allow for poor handwriting, it would allow for any variation of the candidate's name that was clear enough for the director to determine using the standard of effectuating voter intent and enfranchising a voter in order to count the vote. The court did not find that the statute required that the candidate's name be written in exactly as on the declaration of candidacy, and in fact, the declaration of candidacy sets out a Murkowski, Lisa as an example standard, and you know you can't expect voters to write that in. I mean, obviously they're going to write in the name in the ordinary common sense way that people write in a name. So the court rejected that argument and upheld the division standard for counting ballots where there were minor variations in the spelling, some poor handwriting, things of that nature.
Yeah. And there's some questions that kind of relate to that further down here about similar names and so on. But let's wait till we get there to address those.
Okay.
Please continue. Any questions here? Continue.
The next question talks about the process for determining voter intent, who initially reviews the ballots, and how far up the chain of the command does the ballot and the review go before being accepted or thrown out. The division would go through the process of counting individual write-in votes like we did after following the 2010 general election if the total aggregate number of write-in votes satisfies the threshold set out in regulation, which is either the highest number of votes received for that race over any other printed candidate on the ballot, or the second highest, and the difference between the highest vote received by a candidate in write-ins is less than half of a percent. And that's found in State Regulation 6 AAC 25085.
So it's half a percent. For example, in a couple of the legislative races where there's a write-in candidate, they got a very, very small number of votes. So you didn't bother counting those individually. You had X number of write-in votes for those folks, but we don't know you know, the exact number. I'm sure some of them, they didn't mention, there goes my phone again. Would somebody do something with my phone? That may be one of the candidates calling in. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There were write-in candidates in-house races, and those write-in votes do not meet the thresholds in regulation.
Because they weren't enough votes.
Because they were not. They were not the top vote getter, and the difference between the top vote getter and write-ins was well above the 0.5% margin.
I see. So we know they may have gotten X amount, of which maybe 3 or 4 might have been for Mickey Mouse or something, rather than how they put it on their declaration of candidacy.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. In those races, we did not go through, and we do not know individually who those write-in votes were for.
Okay, so we just only know that they got no more than the number that were cast.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
I provided the staff to the committee yesterday a copy of the process that we use for counting write-in votes, and can briefly just go over that. The ballots were sorted by election workers. We had 15 teams of 2 workers, and they sorted the ballots into 5 categories. Those ballots with a vote for a candidate whose name was printed on the ballot were placed in box 1, and those ballots were not looked at all by myself. I did not have to review those ballots because they were ballots that the oval was filled in for a candidate whose name was printed on the ballot. Those with no oval filled in, blank or overvoted, were placed in box 2. The ballots with a write-in candidate where there was no challenge at all to the name that was relevant to this case, Lisa Murkowski, those that were perfectly spelled and were placed in box 3 and not reviewed any further.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'm trying to find the right document. Is that the one that's signed by Sam Reed?
He's Secretary of State.
Document that I'm referring to through the chair, Representative Seaton, is Counting Write-In Votes, U.S. Senate Race.
If we could just have a minute to try to find that in the blizzard of paperwork.
Do you want to add these?
No, I don't.
No, he doesn't.
I'm just trying to find that thing.
Mr. Chairman, do you have a copy so we can see what that looks like?
Yeah, it looks like this. And it was emailed to everybody.
Maybe we just need a second, Mr.
Chairman.
At ease.
Thank you.
Please come back to order. And who is speaking last?
Yes.
The process I was discussing on this was the initial ballot sort that you find on page 1 of that 3-page handout.
I see, okay.
And those ballots that were perfectly spelled, had an oval or some kind of a mark, had the oval filled in or some kind of mark in the oval, had the name Lisa Murkowski spelled correctly, that were not challenged by either of the parties that had observers there, were put in box 3. Box 4 were those ballots that were challenged by one party or the other. Misspellings, perhaps the name wasn't written directly on the line, the oval was not filled in. Box 5 were those write-in votes for a candidate other than Lisa Murkowski. I reviewed the ballots in boxes 2 and 4. There was no other person involved in making the voter intent calls. The Alaska Supreme Court validated that this was a good process in the Miller v. Treadwell, that there was consistency, and there was one person making that determination.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that. One person made their decision, whatever it was. We didn't have different people with different eyes looking at it, just one person, and it was you.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grunberg.
I did read that case. Do you have the citation on that, Ms. Felix?
I don't have the citation on it. I can get that for you.
I would appreciate it if you could get that to Ms. Manley, who at some point then she could distribute that, because I think that being familiar with that case will help us really understand what went on here, because the Supreme Court was very detailed in explaining what happened and why they affirmed the procedure. I wish I had it in front of me. I've read it.
So, Mr. Chairman, that ends the discussion on voter intent and who made those determinations. So okay, I'll move on to the next question.
Any questions on this part? Okay, please.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
I also don't have a copy of the Senate bill that's going to deal with some of this that we may be looking at. My question is a legal question, and I don't know if it's to you or Ms. Felix, if I may have a little leeway here. What is the standard of proof that's required here in the legal sense to determine voter intent? Is it a preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing evidence? And if so, how does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the court did not use those sorts of standards. The court did not use a preponderance of the evidence or the sort of standards that you'd use in proving a case. The voter intent standard is a different kind of standard than that. It is a standard where the director looks at the ballot, views the totality of the ballot, looks at it, each part of it in relation to the other, and makes a determination with the underlying consideration of enfranchising a voter, if possible.
May I follow up, please?
Follow up.
Okay, when a court reviews an agency determination of any type, they use different types of analyses based upon how technical the decision below was. If it's a very technical geological question in oil and gas, then they're not likely to substitute their own standard for it, because they'll defer to that kind of expertise. On the other hand, other things that are more within a court's or a judge's sphere of knowledge, they're more likely to substitute their judgment for. And I would ask either of you, in that legal sense, what was the standard that was applied by the court, or what is the standard of deference or discretion that the court uses to determine? I assume that the issue is whether there's been an abuse of discretion, a clearly erroneous factual determination below. What is the deference that's given the Division of Election in these cases?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I know what you're talking about, but the court, and you know, usually cases will do that kind of analysis, but in elections cases, when they're reviewing a ballot determination, they really don't use that sort of traditional deference to the agency or substitution of judgment standard. The decision talked a lot about the history of the court's decisions in reviewing ballots and enfranchising voters, and didn't really use a substitution of judgment or deference to the agency kind of standard. They sort of said these have been our rules in the past, and it looks like the agency followed those rules, and we're going to uphold what the agency did.
Henry Grunberg, follow up.
I may, but I want to process that answer in my mind before I go ahead.
Thank you.
Okay,
please continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next question was.
Would you give a number for it?
I'm on number 7.
Okay.
If a candidate with the first name Elizabeth Doe is commonly known to go by Liz, would a ballot counter have the power to count votes for Liz Doe based upon this knowledge while tossing out votes for Libby Doe or Beth Doe? First, the ballot counter in this instance would be one person, and that would be the director at the Division of Elections would be the one to make a ballot call on voter intent, whether the ballot should be counted for the candidate or not. And second, this question again poses a very hypothetical question that is very difficult to answer, you know, in a vacuum, and it would depend on a lot of factors, including the circumstances of the writing campaign and what appears on the writing.
What's the last part you just said, depending on what?
Depending on the circumstances of the writing campaign. The circumstances.
Certainly, okay.
And what appears on that candidate's write-in letter of intent. The entire name is taken into consideration when determining voter intent. However, according to federal law, the Uniformed Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, any abbreviation, misspelling, or other minor variation in the form of the name of a candidate or a political party shall be disregarded in determining the validity of a ballot if the intention of the voter can be ascertained. And that's currently in our state regulation.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is my understanding correct that Doe is just fine? In other words, you don't need two names for the write-in candidate because the statute's very clear and says the candidate's last name or the name as it appears on the write-in candidacy. So would the, and I'm not asking for a predetermination, but I'm just trying to think that the standard might be if there's not more than one Doe on the ballot, that any variation of Doe that doesn't seem to be designating somebody else would be showing the voter's intent to vote for Doe. Is that kind of where we're getting as to whether you can show voter intent that way or not?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you are correct that last name would be sufficient to determine that the ballot was valid. And you're correct. It would just depend on the situation involving that election. How many candidates had the last name Doe? How many candidates had the first name that began with an E? And so it would be a totality of all the circumstances involving that specific race and the candidates involved before you could make those kind of determinations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if a candidate wanted to run a write-in campaign and filed in their candidate letter of intent that they wanted to use strictly their first name, say if they were so well-known statewide that people just knew them by their first name, like, say, a Madonna or a Cher or something like that, could they just use a name and just put, well, my the name I want to put on here.
I hope Madonna's not running for anything.
I'm just an example.
Through the chair, Ms. Fanumiai is asking me to respond to that question. Through the chair, Representative Peterson, the court kind of addressed that issue in the Miller v. Treadwell case, and what they did is they analogized the write-in letter declaration of intent to the statute on candidates running under a nickname. So there's a specific statute on candidate nicknames. Now, the court didn't really go to the issue of a single name in the decision. That wasn't at issue. So at this point, we're sort of in uncharted ground, and it's hard to know what would be allowed and what wouldn't be allowed. Taking a conservative approach, it would seem like It would have to be a decision, again, it's a hypothetical, it would have to be a decision that would be made at the time considering all the circumstances. So I can't really give a better answer than that.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two general questions here. This write-in race occurred in a federal race, U.S. Senate. Was it governed by federal law or state law or part of both?
Good question.
With respect to write-ins and the counting of write-ins, very specifically on that.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, it was governed by both, mainly state law, which incorporates federal law. The UOCAVA reg on counting absentee military ballots was, of course, followed. Alaska is covered by the Voting Rights Act, so of course we complied with the Voting Rights Act.
If I may.
Continue.
I want to focus my question on just issues relating to the kinds of stuff we're talking about, the counting of the write-ins.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, then state law, which does incorporate the UOCAPA federal law standard in that regulation.
Okay, second question.
Go ahead.
There is a statutory framework, but it sounds like there are procedures that the division is using. Some of these procedures have been just developed as a result of the Murkowski-Miller race that you implemented some new, because there really hadn't been ever anything like this. There had been the Robin Taylor race and stuff, but nothing really serious close like this. Have you now developed procedures? And if so, are you going to put them in the form of regulations and promulgate them pursuant to the APA? What I'm interested in, folks, through the chair, is that as this committee and the other committees in the legislature are going to be dealing with this subject this year, and if we don't finish it this year, next year, that we have the complete framework that the division is now going to be less concerned about what happened in the past than what's going to happen in the future. And what I need to know is, what is out there now, and is it in the form of informal procedures? Are there going to be regulations? And then my final question will be, I'd like a copy for the committee of all documentation so we know the entire written legal framework that we'll be legislating against. Through the chair, could you answer that?
So, as I understand it, these situation questions arose during the election, and you didn't know what to do at that time, so you developed a procedure after the fact, and now we're considering procedures for future elections. Am I framing that correctly?
Yeah.
That was my question.
Right. In my words.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right.
Through the chair, just as a preliminary matter, if you would, in response to Representative Gruenberg's question, the Alaska Supreme Court specifically considered the issue of whether or not what the division did in this case required a regulation to be promulgated under the Administrative Procedures Act, and specifically found that a regulation was not required. These are internal agency procedures that were a common sense interpretation of existing statutes and regulations that did not require promulgation of a new regulation. I just wanted to get that on the table, and Ms. Benoumiai has...
Through the chair, I understand that, but I'm wondering in what form are these new procedures going to be, because my thought as an attorney is they ought to be in writing so that you have a written process that future administrations and yourselves can follow, that people who are litigating this will know what the rules are, and so that the courts and the public will know. I would hope that you're going to put something in writing, and I'm wondering if you are, or whether that's been done, what form that's going to be. Also, if the legislators need to know, too.
Well, yeah, and of course, you know, your definition of common sense may be different from mine. I know mine very different from a lot of the other folks in this building. So you know, it just depends.
Yeah.
Please.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the procedures that the division put in writing were the writing counting procedures that I provided to the committee. I think it's difficult to put in writing a procedure determining on how you establish and determine voter intent, because it is an election by election basis. It is done with a great deal of thought. It's not done just on a whim. The Department of Law is heavily involved, and I don't think, and Sarah can correct me, that it's possible to put down in writing the process that I used, other than, you know, looking at a ballot, determining who the candidate was that was writing it, and it is what was written enough to for me to determine that Susie or that this voter wanted to vote for Lisa Murkowski. The writing counting procedures that we, the division, you know, could put those into a policy procedure. So they're in writing, they're there, the next group that comes along would follow those same procedures. I think it's, and Sarah can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, it would be very difficult to put in writing how you would make a voter intent call.
Through the chair, Sarah Felix again, and as Representative Gruenberg mentioned, there is going to be, we do have it in reg now about the Uocava ballots, and there is the Senate Bill 31, which is pending now, is going to codify in statute the Uocava standard that any abbreviation, misspelling, or other minor variation in the form of the name of a candidate or political party shall be disregarded in determining the validity of the write-in ballot if the intention of the voter can be ascertained. So there will be that standard set out in law, assuming that SB 31 passes. And we do have that standard set out in the Alaska Supreme Court case of Miller v. Treadwell. And the division has been advised and throughout the years has always followed the Alaska Supreme Court precedent on counting ballots.
Seemingly the procedure to determine intent, that's a problem to develop such a procedure. I mean, that goes to the heart of the whole thing, does it not? What? How do we determine procedure? To determine procedure, you have to be able to define intent. And I don't know, intent really been defined? You know, I don't know what's going on inside of somebody's head.
Mr. Chairman, that's true. I mean, you don't know. But by looking at a ballot, when you review the ballots and you look at the ballots and you know the candidates involved in the case and in the race and you can look at ballots and make a determination that this person was trying to spell Murkowski and they put a Y on the end instead or they put a C instead of a K. And
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fanumia is looking at me. I'll give you, if you would, I could give you an example from
okay.
an older case, from the Bryce v. Edgman case. And in that case, the court looked at Bryce v. Edgman. Edgman v. Moses, sorry.
Yeah, we know.
The court looked at the whole ballot. We had a situation where there were a number of ballots that had funny marks on them, but the court was able to figure it out. They were able to see that the voter meant to cross out a name and they meant to vote for another candidate. You look at the whole ballot and you can see a pattern on the ballot. And the director, and that was a different director, and you know the director usually is able to make that determination. In that case, the director made a different determination and the court refocused our attention on looking at the entire ballot and figuring out what the voter meant to do. If they have filled in the oval completely for the first six candidates and then on the next race they cross out one of the candidates and fill in the oval for the other candidate who's running against the crossed out candidate, we don't disregard that vote. The court has said no, you cannot disregard that vote. You must count the vote for the candidate whose name is filled in, because obviously when you look at the whole ballot, seeing all those filled in ovals, that's a cross out and the voter was just trying to make a correction. Now, as you said earlier, Mr. Chairman, that voter probably should have, for a cleaner process, gone and gotten a new ballot, should have taken that ballot and made it a spoiled ballot, but the court is not going to disenfranchise the voter because they didn't do the best thing. They're going to count that ballot because it's clear from looking at the entire thing that voter meant to vote for that filled in oval candidate. Sure. Hope that helps.
It does. Representative Gruenberg?
And this is, I don't need an answer now, Ms. Felix, on this. But it would seem, at least in that case, the court looked at the determination that the director had done, and I'm just using the facts as you've given them here within the last 2 minutes, and then looked at the ballot de novo. On its own, the judges actually made an independent determination. So in that sense, at least on the facts you've given us, they used a substitute standard and they didn't give the director any discretion. It was as though they said, you know, I can look at this ballot and see what the intent was just as easily as whatever the name of the director was. And they used a substitution of judgment standard, implicitly, if not explicitly, from the facts as you've related them. Am I correct?
Through the chair, in that case, I think you are correct. The Miller v. Treadwell decision was a little different,
yeah,
but in the Edgemond v. Moses, you I think you were correct.
Any more?
No.
Okay. Representative Keller.
I just want to back up a little bit and say thank you to the chair for bringing this forward. And the reason is not for our edification, but number of voters out there is getting percentage-wise grim. And I think the confidence that the citizens have in the voting process is a very important factor. And therefore, I really appreciate you bringing this up. In that context, I'd like to ask you if you're comfortable with the responsibility placed on you to make that decision solely. And I was sitting here thinking of myself. Let's say it was a race like that, and it really did get down to one or two votes. You know, I would want to run from that responsibility. And I was thinking that, you know, I mean, it might be seem easy, you know, if there's a cushion of votes there. But it's a very important thing. But I also sympathize what you're saying. You try to write this down, and it gets all you do is open something up for, you know, continued fighting. We don't want to do that to harm our confidence in the voting system. But I guess it's a lead in to the question of is that particular aspect of the regulations per procedure, whatever, been considered? I mean, like maybe three or four people or five people or something, an odd number that would be there to check and balance something besides the courts, Representative Grunberg just pointed out. You know, have you thought of that, like your response, how comfortable you are with having that responsibility?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I felt very comfortable doing what I did. I received excellent advice from the attorneys at the Department of Law. You know, decisions were consulted with Department of Law. I believe that any person in my position would take the task that they were handed in this very seriously and continue to work honestly and do the best to the best of their ability, enfranchise every voter's ballot to make sure that it's counted. I'm not sure if applying a group of four to five people to kind of, if that's going to get you a clearer answer, because then again, you have four or five people who might see things differently. I believe that was perhaps one of the issues in Bush v. Gore or something, because there were multiple counties that, you know, ran elections in that election. And I feel that it's for consistency's sake and for that it's best that, you know, one person is assigned the job of doing that. And I feel the division, that is a responsibility of the director of the Division of Elections.
Representative Keller.
Thank you. And please don't take my question as directed, you know, at you personally. But that leaves me with a question, because one person, I think all, as a human being, we have our biases, and this could get pretty subjective. Let's say we got down to one vote, you know, difference, and I'm just making something up here. The name is Doe, and somebody spells it D-O. I mean, you see, at some level, you know, the subjectivity there, you can't completely solve it, but you don't want to leave it. There is a potential when it's one person for a bias to show, and that's why I asked the question. You know, and I wish I could offer the golden solution. I don't have it. You know, I'm just raising the question because that makes me uncomfortable that when it gets down to one person to determine somebody else's intent. You know, that just really makes me squirm. You know, I just.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I understand where you're coming from, and I don't take any offense to what you're saying. And Ms. Felix would like to respond to that.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the process of the write-in count involved observers from every campaign involved and all the political parties. So while the director is making this decision as a single person, she is observed in that decision by all the observers. It is an open process, and if there were any biases or funny business going on, it would be patently obvious.
Thank you.
And then, so you're there looking at this ballot, you make a decision, and other people are watching you do this, and what if they disagree?
Challenge.
Mr. Chairman, if I made a determination to count the ballot for Lisa Murkowski and the Miller Observer objected, then it went into a challenge count. It went into a challenge counted envelope. It was counted for Lisa Murkowski, but it was the challenge was maintained in the event that the court needed to look at those ballots to make the determination whether or not it should.
So then, if necessary, it would escalate to the court.
Correct.
To make their intent.
Correct.
Decision.
And Mr. Chairman, that was what was done in the Edgman-Moses case, because there was a very few ballots involved with that case. In this instance, the number of challenged ballots involved was in the neighborhood of like 8,300 ballots. I'm sure if the court felt it was necessary to look at those, they would have, though. So.
But because it's such a large number,
Well, that and the circumstances involving the whole case, they determined they didn't need to look at them.
Right. At least I remember sitting up nights watching the counting of Chads in the Florida thing. I'm glad we don't have Chads. Let's don't ever do that.
Right.
Representative Grunberg.
Is this process governed by the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the Alaska Supreme Court in the Miller v. Treadwell case specifically found that the division was not required to adopt a regulation under the APA.
I'm not referring to the rulemaking provisions. The Administrative Procedures Act, for everybody's information, contains two different bodies of law. One is rulemaking, the procedures to adopt regulation. The other, and that's quasi-legislative. The other is quasi-judicial, which is the adjudication of disputes. And that's in AS 4462, 320, and following. And those are the regs, those are the statutes I'm talking about, Ms. Felix, with respect to the administrative adjudication. Is this governed by APA? You're shaking your head.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, no.
Should it be?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's a big policy question, and I don't know that I can answer it at this point.
That's not even fair. I would appreciate it if the division would consider that question as we legislate, because the Administrative Procedures Act is a uniform act modeled on the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, and it's used in many, many agencies, and I would like to know the division's advice on whether we should incorporate AS 4462 320 to, I think, 362, somewhere in that area. That chapter dealing with administrative adjudication, whether that should be legislatively incorporated in your procedures in the future. I'd like an answer in writing on that.
Very good. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just discussing this topic, you know, generally, it seems like Administrative Procedures Act is there to govern a very broad array of circumstances, and we have a law here that deals specifically with election law. So, you know, it's kind of like we've superseded the general APA, Administrative Procedures Act, to focus directly on elections and say this is how it will be, and the votes will be, you know, segregated, and the courts will have this jurisdiction. So I think that if we tried to go back and say we're going to subject our very specific statutory and regulatory authority to a broad general category, it would confound and confuse. And so I'm seeing
I think that wasn't one of my better suggestions.
So anyway.
So you don't have to give that. Okay. Let me put it like this. Unless you think that would, because that deals with administrative law judges and stuff, and you don't want to go that route. So I think we can truncate that inquiry. Thank you. Thank you for consideration and your courtesy in not shooting it down like my friend to the left.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, the next question is question number 8, and it talks about situations in which writing only one name would suffice to meet voter intent standard. At minimum, per statute, the last name of the candidate must be provided. It would, of course, depend on the circumstances of the election. If there was one Johnson running, then Johnson last name only would suffice, and the division would be able to determine voter intent that that was a vote for Susie Johnson.
Yes, I think you kind of touched on that one of the earlier, one of the earlier questions. I think you did.
Yeah.
And I just really just put these questions down from the members of the committee who sent those questions in, and some of the staffs of the various committee members here are included here. So some of them may be, pretty closely related. Please continue.
Number 9, Mr. Chairman, how closely must a name match the way it's written on the write-in declaration to signal voter intent? Can we assume someone who writes in J. Johnson means to vote for the John Johnson who submitted a declaration of candidacy? Again, it's a hypothetical question that without knowing the whole circumstances surrounding the election is kind of difficult to answer. But if, like I said earlier, if there was only one candidate with the last name Johnson that had a first name starting with J, then I believe that voter intent would be clear on that one. However, the last name of the candidate must be provided at minimum. And again, the division, uses a common sense approach and phonetic standard drawing on the federal law that we talked about earlier from the regulation about any abbreviations, minor misspellings, variations, form a name should not be, disregarded in determining the validity of the ballot.
Okay. Next, number 10, maybe?
Number 10, talks about if the legislature passes a bill that addresses a current statute, the presumption is the legislature is changing or revising the interpretation of statutes. If the legislature agrees with the court's interpretation of the current statute, would a resolution be a more applicable vehicle to show our agreement with the Supreme Court's interpretation of existing statutes, since a revised statute would imply we are making a change from existing interpretation? The division feels that conforming the statute to the court decision is essentially a housekeeping measure, and it's also my understanding on talking with the Department of Law that a resolution would not be sufficient enough to amend the statute.
Reverend Seaton.
Thank you, and I guess that came to our conclusion. A resolution would not be sufficient to amend the statute, but if we pass a statute, are we therefore amending the statute instead of agreeing with the current interpretation of the statute? In other words, if we agree with the Supreme Court and with the division that it's voter intent that what is what we want to do through the statute, if we don't have disagreement with the current way in which the voter intent is being determined, and we pass a statute, I guess as long as we clearly show our intention that we are merely agreeing with current procedures and we are not amending or not changing the statute and not saying that we disagree with the way it's been interpreted, we would be okay. My question comes from, we had some lunch and learn with the court last year, and we've had some conversations, and there's been cases before the Supreme Court. It's really great because every Sunday afternoon, Alaska and the courts has a Supreme Court arguments, and there was months ago, there was an argument there where the lawyers were arguing that there was a statute change. There was a statute put in that modified a previous that did something. It was actually the same, but the whole presumption is that the legislature does not pass a statute unless it means to change something. We don't pass the same statute over again. And so I just want to make sure it's clear and we get the agreement from a law that if we go forward with a statute that agrees with the interpretations that we currently have through the Supreme Court and all, that it's known that we are not changing the law. We are simply making clear what we currently is in statute as adopted by the Supreme Court. I think it's one of these things that we just want to make sure we don't have a future court argument that we changed the law when what we were doing was just trying to agree with the Supreme Court in our current law.
Well, it's ratifying it, I guess.
Yes. Clarifying.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes. I mean, and we also discussed this in Senate Judiciary about SB 31, and your legislative record, what you're doing today, is something that will stand for posterity that we can turn to if there's any litigation and make it clear that exactly what you said is what the legislature is doing. I mean, you're just conforming the statute to the court's decision.
That's a little bit of what I meant early on. You know, I want to make sure that nothing we said here would affect one way or the other the current litigation in progress. But I guess what we say here today and maybe do at some future date could impact future court cases on similar issues. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
That's scary. Representative yeah. Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we can also put a purposes section at the beginning.
Through the chair, and in the uncodified part of the bill, they considered that in Senate Judiciary. They didn't do it, but Ledge Legal was there, and they said
I'm
you could do that.
Paul's question.
You know, you could do a little intent section that says, right. No, we want to implement Miller v. Treadwell, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Continue if you wish.
Mr. Chairman, number 11, has there ever been any write-in candidate issues, either primary or general, in any comparison prior to November 2010, and what about in other states? There was nothing in comparison to 2010.
One more time?
There has been nothing that compares to the level of the write-in candidate race in 2010. As you all are aware, in 1998, Robin Taylor did run as a write-in candidate for governor, but that was on a much smaller scale, and did not have an impact on the final results of the race. I think Mr. Taylor received about 40,000 votes in that race. And I believe that in 1954, Senator Strom Thurmond was elected to the U.S. Senate from South Carolina as a write-in candidate. That's the only other one I'm aware of. I have not had the opportunity to research write-in candidates in other states.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you take a look at South Carolina's legal posture at that time? Were there any legal challenges, any appellate or written decisions in that matter that would be at all relevant?
Through the chair, Representative, I did not.
Okay. Thank you.
I know Department of Law did a lot of research on writing candidates during this whole process.
But maybe I should ask Ms. Felix same question.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. We did a lot of research, and I know there were a lot of cases we considered. I don't know that any of them went back that far. I mean, this has been an area of there is a lot of case law on it, and I don't think we had anything from South Carolina in that in the brief.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are a unique state. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So am I to understand, other than the federal that there haven't been any House candidates or any of the other elections that we supervise, REAAs or anything else that had write-in candidates that rose to the level that needed to be counted?
Through the chair, Representative, I believe there was an REAA, a Regional Educational Attendance Area School Board candidate that won as a write-in, but I can't remember the year it was. But to the best of my knowledge, that's it.
Okay.
President Grunberg.
Just by way of footnote, a movie was playing here last week called Gerrymandering. And in that movie, there was an incident talking about how somebody got elected to a city council in a location where the district was primarily a prison where they couldn't vote. Three votes were cast, and it was 2-1 or something like that. And one of them was disqualified for lack of residency. So these things come up in weird ways. I think those were all write-ins because nobody had signed up for the office.
I'm not going to pursue that. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, number 12 talks about if a Joan Jones conducted a write-ins campaign against Joe Jones, what intent problems would you foresee? Again, you know, it would just depend on the circumstances. And
keep coming back to circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, and we would anticipate that the campaigns would work hard to get the message out on how to write the name properly. If there's two Joneses, make sure you write Joan and make sure you write Joe, because if they just were to write Jones and you had two Joneses running for the same office, I think it would be very difficult to determine who that candidate intended, I mean, who that voter intended to vote for.
What would you do in that case? Just throw them both out?
I would just say it would be a not counted ballot. And then I'm assuming both sides would then challenge it, and then it would go to the courts, and my assumption would be that if the votes were needed to determine, you know, the winner of a race, if the race was so close, that they would then look at them and perhaps do some kind of a, what do we call it, a proportionate, but it wouldn't be a reduction, it would kind of be a
proportionate redistribution of the votes?
Yeah, something along those lines. It would be very complex mathematical, you know.
Okay.
Number 13. What was the outcome of a list of write-ins being posted in voting booths? The write-in lists, the division never intended for the write-in lists to be posted in voting booths. They were to be made available to a voter if they requested assistance on how to spell a write-in candidate name, wanted to know who the write-in candidates were. There was an incident in a Homer absentee voting location, Representative Seaton, that for a very brief period of time, I think it was about 2 hours, where the absentee, the person in the clerk's office decided they posted a list in the booth.
We're the election department and we're here to help.
Yes. And as soon as we learned about it, it was immediately removed. There were 17 people who voted during that period of time. We kept those ballots separated from the other ballots, so they were not commingled. They were all counted according to state law, but put back in their ballot envelopes because they were absentee in-person ballots. And in the case that those ballots were going to be challenged at a future date, and there was no further challenges to those ballots.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just trying to figure out the rationale for that. I mean, we put the list of people that are on the ballot, that's provided, it's on the ballot mm-hmm. itself. So the list of candidates is on the ballot that is printed and provided. So what's the rationale for not providing the list of candidates who have qualified and that are available for selection, just as if they were on the ballot? And I'm just having a hard time figuring out what the rationale. I mean, I understand people are upset, but I'm trying to find out the rationale for providing the list of people that are qualified candidates in one aspect and then not providing the list of qualified candidates in the other aspect.
Do you want to handle that, or is that a piece?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this was a matter over which there was litigation also. There was a delicate balance that the division was required to walk. There were those who challenged the use of the list at all. They wanted to bar the list. There were those who wanted the list to be posted. The division developed a policy that they felt was fair and would help the voters if the voters needed help in having the list available if a voter asked for it. The Alaska Supreme Court, this went through the court system very quickly. The Alaska Supreme Court ultimately upheld the division's decision, and that is, in a nutshell, what happened with the list.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand they upheld the decision. It doesn't mean they would have overturned another decision. And I'm trying to figure out what the rationale is providing a list of those that were qualified candidates and not providing the list in the ballot boxes, which you have them printed on the ballot, the list of candidates here. You have a certain list of people who have qualified under the state regulations for certifying a candidacy for a write-in candidacy, and then not providing those names. And that's what I'm trying to find out.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the challengers claimed that would have given the write-in voters an unfair advantage, that would have meant that the poll workers were assisting the write-in campaign, that it would have influenced voters in making their decision, and those were the reasons that the division did not post the list, I think. And I'll let Ms. Fanumi I follow up on that. But again, it was a delicate balancing. It was a difficult decision. The division tried for a compromise position, and you may be correct. Maybe the division could have prevailed if they'd posted the list, but that wasn't the decision they made, and the court did uphold the decision they made to make the list available upon request, so that's what the division is going with.
And follow up?
And yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what I'm doing is not at all saying that the division in a past case didn't do anything. I'm trying to figure out how we say that you're a qualified candidate and we're going to give everybody your name on the ballot. And this other group of people that went through the procedures that we lay out in statute, whether we change those procedures or not, those are the procedures that we have to become a qualified candidate, and we don't provide those names in the same place when the people are voting. And so I just, you know, we're in a generalized discussion here, and so that's what I wanted to bring out. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the next question is, by what criteria is the voter registration database searchable? I believe this question is asking about what information is available to the public from the state's voter registration list. Is that correct?
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Because they can't record your nod.
Right. Sorry.
As many of you are probably aware, the list is available to be purchased by members of the public. It can be purchased as a paper list or electronically. We don't sell very many paper lists anymore because people want to use the electronic list to you know, query and search and et cetera. The public list contains the registered voters' names, an accession number, which is not their voter number, but it's a number that, you know, folks can use to find a voter if they want. Residence address, mailing address, district, precinct, party affiliation, sex, and 10 years of voter history. And the electronic list is a comma-delimited ASCII text file that, from my understanding, can be sorted if you know how to do that kind of stuff, which I don't, in a variety of ways. You can search by name. You can search for all the undeclared voters in House District 24, say, or you could search for all the registered voters in the state with the name Fanumii, or however you want to use that data and search. I think it would be up to the person who gets the list how they want to use that data.
And so anybody, say, can get that list. I know 99.9% of the candidates have these lists.
Correct.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But you would not be able to search through the list by who had been the registrar that had registered the people to vote?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I don't believe we do not have the capability of tracking registrations by a registrar.
Follow up.
Specific registrations to a registrar. They're not, when they're entered in our voter registration system, they're batched according to where they come from, like a registrar, but it's not tied to a specific registrar.
Follow up.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So once the voter is added to the list of qualified voters, there's no way to track who was the original registrar for that voter. The original paperwork is tossed out once it's entered in the computer.
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, no, the hard copy of the paper is kept and microfilmed. If a request came to the division to want to know who registered a, you know, specific voter, we could query the microfilm and print the documents and determine if we received a voter registration document from a specific registrar and they signed the document as a registrar, we would be able to provide that information.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Number 15, I'm unclear what this question was about. What resources would the division need to make database searches by any all criteria?
Ms. Ann Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It was basically along the same lines of the previous question, because in my last campaign, we had come across some information that made us question whether some people who were registered to vote were actually citizens. And so we were trying to find out who actually had signed them up and how they were allowed to be added to the voter rolls if they in fact were not citizens. And the reason that made me question that is because I was going door to door, I would go to the address on my walking list and ask for a certain person, and a couple of times that person wasn't home, but one of their parents or siblings told me, well, why are you asking for them? Because they're not a citizen, so they are not going to be voting. And so that made me question whether they were legitimately registered.
And Mr. Chairman, that leads then into the next question, talking about how do we verify the citizenship of newly registered voters. When a voter completes the voter registration application, they're signed under penalty of perjury that the information they provide is true and correct. And the first box on the voter registration form might ask two questions. Are you at least 18 years of age? And are you a United States citizen? And the Division of Elections takes that on face value based on what the oath is, that that person is swearing they are a United States citizen.
So if they say they are a citizen, that's under penalty of perjury, and you register them as voters.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
So you're not involved in any immigration issues like that? We had another bill here, HB3, where some question about is not the part of the state of Alaska determined to get involved in immigration issues, so you don't, or what? I mean, you see what I'm saying? We have one group of saying, hey, we can't. That's federal territory. We can't get involved in immigration issues. And this 16, that's kind of an immigration issue, is it not?
Mr. Chairman, I believe U.S. citizenship and naturalization is tied to immigrations. But at this point in time, that is how the division handles that. If it was brought to the division's attention that there was proof that somebody was not eligible to be a voter, then, of course, we would research it and then follow the procedures that would be to remove that person from the rolls.
Okay. On the same point?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it would be possible for someone who was out registering people to vote, if the person they were registering was not able to speak English proficiently, and they had the registrar helping them fill out the registration form, it would be possible for that registrar to check on the ballot that said they were a citizen without actually seeing proof of a citizenship.
But through the chair, Representative Peterson, well, first we would hope that a registrar wouldn't check a box without getting confirmation from somebody that, yes, they are a citizen or no, and if they're not a citizen, then they would inform them, I'm sorry, you can't register to vote at this time.
And what documents do they use to show?
There are no documentations required, Mr. Chairman.
So you just ask?
Yes. And they do have to, you know, when you're registering someone, you would hope the registration is conducting their duties as a registrar faithfully and according to law. And so, Representative Peterson, that would be a very unfortunate circumstance if that has happened.
Well, I can see that. If you get a packet of voter registration to go out and try to register people to vote, the people who do that really don't have a way to determine if somebody's a citizen or not.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Peterson, through the chair, if you, you know, have names of specific people you would like us to look into, just let me know and we would be willing to look at those registration documents.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up. So we would have to specifically ask for each individual that you checked on their citizenship or on?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I think what you would do is give us the name of a voter and we would then look at their documents we have microfilmed and determine what they checked on that and then let you know that, yes, they checked they were a U.S. citizen. And I'm not honestly quite sure how far investigative authority goes as to furthering that checking with INS, or if that would be something that then the person asking for the information would then follow up on.
Follow up.
So then if we had anecdotal evidence from a parent or a sibling that said that they weren't citizens, how would we, and they checked the box that said they were citizens, what would be the procedure?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, that's a good question because the division has a responsibility to have accurate voter lists. So my assumption, and it's only an assumption because I haven't had to do this in my time at the division, would be that we would then do some checking to make sure that that person really was truly a qualified voter.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Let me ask you, jump on the same topic.
Yes.
Yeah, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now that we're kind of talking about this, when I was out campaigning, going door to door this past year, I had somebody with me from the same town, you know, and because I've got several different towns, and many times she'd say, "Oh, they don't live here anymore," and then we would go to where they were, but that happened many times. And is there ever any PSAs or anything that go out just generally to the all of our constituents, you know, that say, you know, make sure if you move that you send it, you know, you get your voter registration address changed? Because people just don't even think that. I mean, it's not, they don't do that purposely at all. They just forget that, you know, there's so much going on when you move. And they don't think to do that because there was a lot of them the people that lived there weren't the people that I had on my list, on my walking list.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, prior to every election, we send out PSAs and we do advertising about updating your registration, making sure your registration is current and accurate. Other than that, that's about the extent of what the division does. You're correct, though. I mean, I don't believe voters intentionally, they just forget. I mean, you move, I don't know how many people update their address with DMV even when they move. But a voter does have, you know, if they have left the state, and that's a different issue from what you're talking about, you know, has a right to remain registered in the state of Alaska as long as they claim an intent to return to the state.
Follow up?
Just a follow up. Maybe it might be a good to do it not in an election year where there's not so much going on, and maybe, you know, it would just be a more calm time and people might think of it to do it. Oh, yeah, I've got to do that. Because there was quite a few of them.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's something definitely we will take into consideration this year.
Another thing I want to check on, this happened to me not the last election, but, you know, before that. Somebody registered, you know, as a candidate, and for the address put it on the post office box. And I went in and I said, "Well, that's fine. I don't think he lives in the post office box, but what is his physical address?" And I was told that's not available. Is that correct, or just one worker, or what?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Voters do have the right, according to state statute, to keep their residence address confidential. If they choose, there's a box on the voter registration form that says they request to not have their residence address released on any lists as long as they are able to provide the division with a different mailing address.
So you would have the mailing address, you'd have their physical address, and if you wanted to, you'd go out and knock on the door and see if somebody's actually there. But the other candidates, they have no way of knowing if the person is there or not. They only have a post office box, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The division maintains their residence address, but by state law is not allowed to release that address to the public for a variety of reasons. You know,
what is the intent? What is the reason? Any of the reasons?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume people are doing it for domestic violence issues. Police officers, judges do not like to have their residence address published and to let the public know where they live. I can't speak for everybody, but that's just some examples that come
to mind. Well, I understand maybe peace officers and so on, but still, the other candidate or candidates, do they not have a right to know that that Joe Blow is not even in the district? They just have a post office box in the district or somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, that's a fine line. I mean, I think that at that the division knows where that person resides based on the information they provided, and based on the address that they provided, they are placed in the proper district and precinct.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Representative Seaton.
It seems there's a disconnect. You were asking about a candidate, another candidate, and you're responding about a voter.
Okay.
Is that the same, does that same thing hold true for candidates, that candidates can maintain their the confidentiality of their resident address so that the other candidates can't really know whether they are in the district other than by a P.O. box?
And do you have to be a registered voter to be a candidate?
It's an election.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I would have to check on that, but if according to statute, if any voter lists that they want their residence address to remain confidential, it's our duty to keep that that residence address confidential. They would have to provide it on their documentation of their paperwork when they filed, you know, as a candidate. But I would not, according to the way state law is written right now, be able to release that information unless it is to, I believe, there's exceptions in statute for when that information can be released, and that is...
And I guess just to follow up and clarify, I'm not asking for the voter address to be released, but the candidate's address to be released.
Physical address.
Physical address, because they're filing additional paperwork as candidate, mm-hmm. not as voter. They may be required to be a voter as well, but you wouldn't be releasing voter information. You would be releasing candidate information, and I'm wondering whether that's covered under different statutes.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the candidate's also a voter. The candidate has the rights under AS 1507195 to keep the residence address confidential, as statute is currently written. As Ms. Fanumi, I stated, there are a number of exceptions to 1507195B, and I suppose if the legislature wanted to make it to differentiate between candidates and ordinary voters, you could do a statutory change to implement that, but as it stands now, there's no authority for the division to treat a candidate differently than any other voter in having the right to make their residence address confidential.
Okay, thank you.
You don't actually verify a candidate's address, knowing that I live where I say I live, other than the post office box. I mean, if I say I live and I give my address where I reside, you don't verify it anyway. You just take it under penalty of perjury that I'm putting that down correctly?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I mean, we look at what's currently on the voter registration rolls, and if it's different from what's on the voter registration rolls, we would update that person's residence address accordingly. Just as we do with any voter, they say they live at 1234 Glacier Avenue, we take their word under penalty of perjury that that's actually where they live.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
I'm just trying to figure out, because I remember in the Edmund versus Moses case that was one of the determinations of the Supreme Court, was that you as a division require an absentee voter to write on the outside of their form their residence address, and ballots could be thrown out if they only had a post office address. But if there was a valid resident address, it didn't have to be in the box where you had residence address. If they'd put a resident address, an appropriate kind of resident address, even if it was in the mailing address slot, that the Supreme Court counted those. So in that case, we had the Does that mean for all absentee ballots, then it's released, or was that only released because it went through the court system, or was it even released and it was just reviewed by the court?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that particular ballot was the special needs ballot, and that's a very complicated ballot where, you know, you have a voter with some sort of disability and somebody is doing their ballot for them. And it was very complicated, and it was not the voter, but the helper who hadn't set out his or her address correctly on the form. And the court's ruling was more in the nature of the form wasn't clear enough to make it clear to the helper that he or she had to set out both his mailing address and his residence address on the form. So the court would not throw out that vote simply because the helper failed to supply his residence address. The issue of the confidentiality of a voter's residence address was not at issue in the Edgman v. Moses case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. I think my question was answered.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Well, we have one more here, and then I've submitted a few questions, too. I hope that we have time to get to those.
All right. We'll do the best we can to get to them.
I think we just have
to. Let's go on to question 17. Representative Keller.
Yeah, if I might, I submitted the question. I think it's already been addressed. If you want,
I believe so. Yeah. I mean, there were questions about. I believe we have answered the right question already.
Okay, Representative Grunberg, you had a question to comment or what?
Yesterday, I submitted some additional questions
right,
to
I
you
have,
folks,
you do have those.
And I think the members of the committee have them. And we also have a one-page memorandum from Legislative Research Services, which deals with AS 1515-361. We have a copy of that, and it's also set out on here. And I'm wondering if you could address the questions.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. AS 1515-361 is the statute that disallows the use of stickers on ballots. That statute prohibiting the use of stickers was enacted when the state converted from punch card machines to optical scan machines. The stickers have a potential for causing damage to the unit. The sticker may fall off and damage the ballot, making it you cannot determine, you know, who the voter wanted to vote for. The stickers could peel off and also stick on the reader head of the optical scan unit, which would render that unit dysfunctional, and we would not be able to use it to count ballots. The division plans to continue using optical scan units, that we believe that statute should be retained. We believe that statute should remain in place in order to allow the machines to be able to function properly.
Follow up.
My concern, as I've stated in the second paragraph there, is there if we could find a way to allow them in these very unusual write-in cases, that could make it a lot easier on those people in our state who are not either able or fluent in the English language enough to write in, and it would potentially eliminate kind of litigation we had. I am wondering, would it be possible for the division to communicate with the company that makes those machines to see if there would be a way of addressing this, or if a procedure could be implemented in some way that would allow the use of stickers that yet would not damage the machinery?
Through the chair, Representative, we can definitely, you know, look into talking to the manufacturer of the units and see what they have to say.
I would like you to do that and then maybe let me know or send a letter to the committee. Then we can pass to these other questions.
Fine. That exhausts the written questions.
No, they're
for you. Have two more. Because I want to have time for individual members of the committee to make closing comments and permit her to make
the
closing. Go ahead.
Okay.
We're just going to just look at the clock.
Okay. Mr. Numiai, if you could very briefly touch on these, or you could respond in writing, whichever you prefer.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think 2021 and 22, which were the additional questions that Representative Grunberg presented, can be answered really quickly. He wanted to know if there were any sorts of issues with the observers at the write-in counting process, and we had no issues with any of the observers. They treated each other with respect, and we were able to work cooperatively, you know, under some pretty strenuous circumstances, and there were no fights. There were no. It went very smoothly, considering, you know, it was a very emotional time for those folks. So, how close was the certification deadline when the writing count was completed? We completed the writing counting process on November 17th. The U.S. Senate race was certified by me on December 28th, and the term for the U.S. Senator began on January 3rd. As you know, we weren't able to certify the race for U.S. Senate until the federal court lifted the injunction to certify, which was done on that day, the 28th of December. And at the recount, the division incurred about $50,000 in costs, which included election worker payments, facility rentals, security, and staff time. That does not include the legal costs associated with the Miller v. Treadwell case from the Department of Law, which they have said approximately this time are about in the neighborhood of $150,000.
Clarification.
Representative City.
You said recount. Was there a recount, or was there analysis of the write-in ballot?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I meant write-in counting. The questions came as recount, and I was reading from that, and they meant write-in counting, so thank
we
you.
We did, for the record.
Okay. Do you have any final comments, you folks, like I say?
Mr. Chairman, I did submit one other question.
Oh, yes.
That question on the current statute that says the last name or as it appears on the application, and the question came up in the Supreme Court arguments, was specifically asked, well, what if a candidate said they want their name to, let's say it was, you know, my name is a write-in and I wanted it to read as Lisa Murkowski. I haven't heard any discussion of the, if the division has any proposal so that there would be something further in that that would say, as you know, you can have your name, your last name, or your name as you wish it to appear, as long as that isn't the name of another candidate, or you know, or some clarification so that we don't get someone putting another two write-in candidates with the same name, and then you would have to apportion those between the two write-in candidates, effectively taking each one to half. So I would just like the division to submit something to us as this process goes forward so that we have some way of clarifying that the as you wish it to appear isn't going to be causing confusion to voters.
Mr. Chairman, we can take care of that, Representative Seaton. And we can provide you with some information, too, about what, you know, obviously you're aware of what the Supreme Court said about nicknames such of that sort. And the division wouldn't allow you, Representative Seaton, to run as Lisa Murkowski. So as your hypothetical question that you posed. So.
Do you have any closing comments?
I do not, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate the time to provide you with this information. And if you have any additional questions, please let me know, and we would be happy to respond and get you whatever information you need.
I again want to thank you for your effort in all the various elections, and thank you for helping clarify, at least to some degree, this very important subject. I'm going to go across here. We only have just a few minutes for some closing comments, if you all choose to do it. First of all, Representative Johansson, are you still there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any closing comments?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
I just did have one comment. If Ms. Mei can look into the question of putting stickers on the ballot and contemplate whether if a candidate had thousands of ink stamps created and handed them out to voters. Could they walk into the booth and simply stamp, like we have copy stamps and draft stamps we use in legislature? Something for to think about. I mean, would that be something that would be allowed? Other than that, I appreciate her hard work during this very stressful campaign election. Thank you.
Okay. Quickly, any other comments? Reverend Seaton?
Thank you. And I would hope that you would be able to give us a little report in the future here on how our 5% of each House district hand recount has functioned, the requirement, and have we had any cases in which the machine tallies and the hand counts don't correspond. And also on that same, how our candidate rotation requirement that we placed on the ballots, has that caused any problems or is that working well? And also I hope that in the future here we can look at an analysis of the mail-in ballot like Oregon does and find out if that has any applicability for Alaska, since we're getting so many candidates. I mean, it's almost a third of the voters are coming in for pre-voting in person, and then their absentee ballots, and they're counted late. So appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, you know, we may have another oversight review in the future sometime, depending on what happens.
Okay.
Reverend Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually just thought of one more question. Maybe you could get to me later, since we're running low on time. Part of the reason that there was so many last-minute write-in candidates was because there was a solicitation for people to go sign up on a radio program, and he was looking for people that had names similar to one of the candidates, and I was wondering if you thought we might need to create some sort of statute to try to prevent that in the future, or maybe some suggestions. Or maybe there already is a statute that covers that. I'm not sure what the situation is, but it did complicate things right at the end.
And when you do that, check any First Amendment issues, you know, on that. Representative Wilson? Okay. Representative Keller?
Yeah. I just want to say thank you again. It's been said, but more importantly is just thanking the thousands of poll workers and election people out there. You know, just backing up and thinking about the forest here, we look at the trees, we don't lose sight of the fact that the voting process is one of the most valuable and unique things we have in America. What comes to mind is other countries that have followed us in this, and the citizens walking around with a dyed thumb. You know, it's a very valuable and incredible thing. And obviously this committee is here, every one of us, because of that process. It's important to us that it's fair and done right, and we certainly don't want to get into this mode of examining it so close that, you know, over legislation or over litigation. The most important part is the local oversight, and so I am indeed very proud and thankful for the poll watchers, the poll workers that are out there, and if I could make a statement to them, it would be, keep at it and be responsible for your election process. Something we have is very valuable. Thank you.
I think that's a very good statement. And of course, we see what's going on in Egypt today. But one of the wonders of our country is that we have very spirited, even heated contests, president all the way down to our level here. And yet it's a peaceful transition of government, and things can happen. We have another election with all the problems, but it works out. Thank you again. Our next meeting is going to be Tuesday, February 8th. It's going to be a very short meeting because the Joint Armed Services Committee starts at 9 o'clock, and everybody's welcome to attend that. We intend to hear HB 19, a special request license plates. With that, again, thank you, everybody, for participating, and we'll see you next meeting. Have a great day.